session number 9253, reel 22.
Jack Dorgan, reel 22. Did you have any other special weapons you used at any time other than the knob carry, which you've already described for us?
Well, before I got my knob carry as I wanted it, that was my trenchant tool handle and the big nut on the end. I still didn't favour taking a rifle out and making a noise by firing it. So what I did with my patrolling and any patrols I took out, and I emphasised that with all the young officers who came out, all we needed was our bayonet in its scabbard, and then that left your hands free. You had your bayonet in its scabbard, it fastened to your belt, and your hands were free for creeping about and doing any jobs needed doing.
Did any of the men use other weapons in No Man's Land that you took out, or did they have any other sorts of knob carry?
It was these young officers, and any time I had a patrol out which had officers who had been out before, they all seemed to favour taking their rifle out with them. The officers, of course, they would never think of going out into no man's land unless they had their revolver on their belt. That so was their protection.
Did anybody else have a knob carry, or was it just you?
No, never met anybody else with anything in the shape of a knob carry.
You mentioned earlier that you saw an attack near Hill 60, some people going over the top. I believe you've got some more details about that. You didn't go over the top yourself during this period. What can you remember about seeing troops attacking?
Well, I have two vivid memories of troops going over the top. One time in 1915, on our immediate left, started one afternoon a very heavy bombardment, not on us, not on our battalion, not on our trenches that we occupied, but on our immediate left and stretching in front into no man's land and way back behind into the reserve trenches on our left. So we gathered from our own knowledge that there were to be something happening on that immediate left. And sure enough, after that intense bombardment, right up to stand two, all the way through the night, we could see the flashes of the heavy guns and the lighter guns on the area, on our immediate left, and the trenches on our next to ours couldn't have been in a very habitable condition at stand two. And immediately stand two finished, the troops that were left and the ones that had been in, mostly the ones from the reserve trenches, went over the top, as we called it. They went over no man's land, had no bother, because we could see everything. Although we were keeping our heads down all the time for our own sakes, of course. But personally, I saw the troops go over no man's land, jump over the German front line trench, never went in, just jumped over, and then they were way back into the land behind the German front line. And that's all we saw. We saw the troops going over with a bayonet fixed. There didn't seem to be in any straight line or anything. They just sort of staggered up and went over Remember, it's rough land and full of shale holes, and they were still under heavy gunfire. Can't remember if there was much machine gunfire on that time. And that was all we saw of it.
Were there many casualties?
There must have been. I couldn't tell you. There must have been from the intense gunfire that had been in preparation before the troops went over on the left. Now, later, in early 1916, we were in trenches on the right of the salient, and we saw a much more spectacular over-the-top. That would be, we're back in March, I should think, 1916, some weeks before the Somme battles. And there, the same procedure, heavy gunfire on our immediate right, none on our trenches, and we're back.
So this is German. What about our bombardment in preparation? Was it mutual bombardment?
I couldn't tell if there was any gunfire. If all guns were firing, they would be firing behind the German lines, dropping their shells. So I have no knowledge of that. I can only tell you what I saw and heard. And what I saw and heard was the preparation by all gunfire on the German trenches, on no man's land, the German trenches, and behind. But it seemed to be much more intensive, our gunfire, on that occasion. And sure enough, we understood why when we saw the troops who had been in the reserve trenches, not in the frontline trenches, our frontline trenches, that had been in our reserve trenches, come up after stand two and go what we called over the top, went over the front, our own frontline trenches into no man's land, right across, and so on. And we found out that they were one of the battalions of the Guards. And it confirmed all we had ever heard of what the Guards were used for. The Guards were never used as fodder, what we called fodder. They were used for the final push. The county regiments, like ours for instance, did the actual fighting beforehand, and then the Guards regiment would come up and make the final assault. And that's exactly what happened on that occasion. We all saw it. The regiment which had been occupying the front line was either wiped out or wounded. And then up came this Guards regiment. Which Guards? I couldn't tell you. But they went over our front line trench, over no man's land, over the Germans, never stopped at the German front line, because they were all demolished, and then away. And I understand on that occasion that they had, the Guards had gone over a mile and a half behind the German trenches. The idea was, at Saint-Eloi, this all happened at a place called Saint-Eloi, and it was a straightening of the line, the idea was. And the Guards stayed where when the Rhine got over the German front line into the back area for that mile and a half. And they stayed there 2 days. Stayed there 2 days and then came out. They were relieved by a county regiment, which then became the cannon fodder, as we called it. A lot of feeling, you know, about that by the county regiments. about the guards being used for these final attacks, and we county regiments being used as cannon fodder.
What did people say? What sort of resentment was there?
Well, you used to curse them, that was all. What else could we do? Among ourselves, you couldn't do anything more. There was no such thing as newspapers or television or anything like that in those days, you know. And all we could do was just grouse among ourselves.
Did you yourself, would you have liked the opportunity to be in a major attack? Did you look forward to going over the top, or was it something you...
No, you've got to remember I was a young man of 21, 22. I was there to do a job, and I did the job as it came along. I don't think I ever had any bitter feelings against the Germans or anything like that. I had never met the German. I mean, I was there in the Northumberland Fusiliers, and I was fighting for my country. And
did you think the Germans were a fair opponent or things like that?
Yes, I think we all treated them with respect, if that's any meaning. Yes, we always considered the Germans as good as soldiers as us.
Did you believe the propaganda stories about them that had been going around in
1940? We didn't get any propaganda. Got to remember, any newspapers we got were sent out in parcels from England. And I'm afraid we didn't take much notice of them. You know, I mean, the propaganda stories that you read about, I mean, take for instance, one time at the Christmas time of 1915, some of the English papers were full of the fraternization between us and the Germans on Christmas Day. I never heard of it, and nobody in my battalion ever saw anything of any fraternization. So we treated all that newspaper talk as well.
What did you call the Germans? I mean, did you
have Huns. Huns. Yes, we always called them the Huns. Never used the word German.
Did you have any sort of communication with them at all at any time? I mean, did they ever pass messages or put boards up or anything like that?
No.
So their status was that of a respected enemy?
Yes, they're the enemy. We treated them as the enemy, and we treated them as being as good as ourselves. So naturally, we respected that, you see. Now then, you mentioned something about how did our fellows react to the war itself. Well,
the strain of it, yes.
Yes, the strain of it. Well, there was breakdowns, you know. Fellows did break down. What happened? I mean, for instance, we had a lot of trench feet, which caused a lot of evacuation or sickness, fellas going back to England with trench feet. Trench feet, of course, was caused by your feet always being wet and never being able to get your feet dry. And I've seen fellas' legs, and you could get your finger and thumb, and you used to go well into the flesh. The flesh became soft and flabby. I never had any twinge feet, so I was lucky.
But you feel that some people got it deliberately to get out, do you?
Oh, yes, there was. Not many, but there was, yes.
What made you think that?
Well, you knew it. You knew it, yes. And it was always the weaker type of fella, you know.
How did you know?
Well, the weaker type of fella. I mean, for instance, you see, my job, being in charge of no man's land, I always took fellas out in no man's land on patrol or on a covering party who one felt you could trust in emergency or would do the bit if necessary. Now, the other fellas would be all right for filling sandbags and repairing your barbed wire near your frontline trench.
And they'd be the ones who go down with trench feet.
But I was other, you see, when I wanted a patrol to go out, I only chose my fellows.
But concentrated on the others. Was it the others that
Yes. Sort of a weaker type, you know. It was always in that, in every way.
Were there any who tried to get themselves out in other ways, either feigning illness or shooting themselves or deliberately getting a minor wound?
There was talk of fellas putting bullets through the legs and so on. Yes.
Did you have any evidence of that? Did you see that yourself?
I only saw one. I know of one. That's all.
What happened that time?
Well, all he did was just taken away, and that was the last of it. Lazenby, they called him, Fred Lazenby.
And
he was always, you see, if you're, when you were in England, for instance, when you were in England and you had a job to do, you wouldn't pick Fred Lazenby. You left him to somebody else. And you see, then when he had to go out to France and so on, and of course Fred was never, he never took Fred out in no man's land. He was a liability. And when he put a bullet through his leg, well, I was going to say good luck to Fred.
Did he do it in public, or did just people just guess he'd done it himself?
I don't know. I never saw it happen. I just knew of it.
Did anybody feign illness or pretend to have...
Fred,
feign illness, pretend to be ill?
It didn't make any difference. If you're ill, you're ill. The doctor wasn't there, you know. The doctor wasn't in the trenches. He was back in the battalion lines and with the... each battalion had a doctor. I never saw the doctor. Never saw the doctor. He was always down back at the horse line. We called them the horse lines.
So people didn't try and pretend to be ill to get out of the line?
Well, if they did, I have no knowledge. They'll get short shift of it. Because, I mean... you see, if one fella got away with a thing like that, there would be a stream of them. They never tolerated those fellas, you see.
Did any of your company or battalion that you know, did they develop any of the symptoms of shell shock, or what they called shell shock?
Oh, yes.
What can you remember about that?
Not very much. You see, you would find in the ordinary way, trench warfare or back resting, a fella sort of became depressed and perhaps wouldn't eat. You know, he went off his food, went off walking about by himself. That was the symptoms that I observed. Now that I think back. And then they were gone. They were gone. Well, you never knew nothing, you see, much. They don't broadcast nothing. You had your own life to live. You hadn't.
Did you believe that there was such a thing as shell shock at the time, or did you?
Oh yes, it could happen to the weaker type of fellow. Oh yes, I mean, I'm not meaning weaker in strength. I mean weaker in mind. That's the type of fellow I'm talking about.
You didn't think that shell shock would happen to someone who was strong-minded, or
if what?
Did you think it could happen to anybody?
Shell shock? No. It could only happen to the weaker type. The fellow who was weaker in his mind and in his ways and his methods and who had been brought up in a soft way at home. You've got to remember that we originally were all miners. They were hard people, we were. And we, you know, to be a miner in those days, you had to be hard and...
So you thought that shell shock could only happen to the weaker sort of person.
We did. That's what I thought. Yes.
If it did happen to them, then it was real.
It was real, and it was a benefit to the others that they were gone, because of all liability. That's the attitude we took. Yes.
Did the strain of being in combat and all the fatigue and all that, did that affect you at
Me?
All?
Me? No. I was always... Well, I don't know. I was just sort of... I had a job to do and I did it.
Did religion play a role in keeping people calm in the front line?
We never had it. There was no padre with us. We didn't have a padre, a parson, you know. There was no parson attached to the old battalion. Not that I ever seen. or ever heard of. No. And the only time we ever went to church was when we were billeted in Armentières. In Armentières, we were billeted in the convent, and on a Sunday morning, if we were out of the trenches, we used to go to church. In Armentières, the town of Armentières, behind the line, mile or so, or 2 miles, I don't know.
And that was the only religious service you saw?
Only, I think, about three times, only.
Did people's personal religion help them to get through?
I have
through
no
it?
Idea.
What about with you?
It never concerned me. No time for it. We had a job to do. We were in trenches. We were out there to win the battle for our country and for our battalion. We always thought of our battalion. We didn't think of England or of being British. We were proud to be Northumbrians.
Does that indicate that although some people may have lost morale and had to go, that the morale of the battalion remained high while
absolutely.
You were with it?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. We were Northumbrians. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. When Tommy Rachel was wounded, the fellow says, "Come on, Tommy, you're a Northumbrian. Come on." But Tommy had to go with a stretcher bearers. And then again, you know, I once read a war book where they talked of the fellow that died in my arms and got his legs broken off. They said, I've got the book in my library. It's by Captain the Honourable Watson Armstrong. He writes about that incident that... And Bob, he writes about that incident where Bob Young and Jackie Oliver were killed. He writes in that book as Bob Young, I understand, this is his words, I understand, was singing Tipperary when he died, which of course is nonsense. I was there when Bob Young died, and he died with his wife's photographed in his hand. He had no thoughts of singing Tipperary. His voice was getting fainter and fainter all the time until he pegged out.
So you think that sometimes writers of, although the morale was high, it didn't go to those ridiculous extents?
Oh, no,
and there was
that's
a lot
ridiculous. The captain wrote that book in there, in my library there. It's ridiculous him saying that Bob Young sang Tipperary as he died. What the captain was trying to imply was that the morale of the Northumberlands was so high that's what happened. But it didn't happen that way.
But the morale was high.
Oh, yes.
I'd like now to ask how you got on with the various elements in the battalion. You know, you yourself, how you got on. How did you get on with the officers in the line?
I got on very well because they all treated me with respect. You've seen one of my war books, which says that he was placed in the hands of Sergeant Jack Dorgan, an experienced patrol leader. Yes, oh yes, I got on very, very well. You see, most of the, not of the older officers, but the replacement officers, all had been through my hands when they first joined the battalion, when they came out as a replacement. And some of them put a brave face on, others wasn't so brave, but I always treated them with respect but kept them in the place which was, they were out there to learn from me. I was in charge, not them.
What did you think of their competence, not in no man's land, but within the trenches? Do you think they were competent, your officers, in running the front line?
Oh yes, more or less. There was a...
Did the standards stay the same? Or did they, was it...
Yes. The big difference in these officers, you've got to remember that the officers we had of the Northumberland Fusiliers were all from North Northumberland. Most of them came from farm stock or from the what we would call the aristocrats. of, not aristocrats, but the landowners in Northumberland, their sins were the officers in the very early days. But after we went out and fellows, officers and men had to be replaced after they had been wounded or killed, we got officers from all over the country. From all over the country, we got them from office rollers and fellows from all different crafts and trades. We seemed to get a lot from officers. At first, they were afraid to get the uniforms dirtied, but they soon lost that, of course. But they always, to me, the officers in our battalion, not all, I would say about 60% of them, always seemed to want to fade away in the background, to keep out of active activity and let the war go on. They were prepared to do the job if necessary, but they won't jump into it, if you can understand what I'm trying. They never put themselves forward, though we had exceptions. We had that exception when I was bringing a wounded man out from No Man's Land. There we had a major came out to help me. And within a minute, he was away back again because he got a bullet through his shoulder. But I mean,
Is this proportion, 60% didn't put themselves forward, would that be the same with the Northumberland county families? And the office wallers, were they pretty well the same in that respect?
Oh, I should think so. You see that...
So there wasn't much difference between the original officers and the office replacements?
Oh, the new ones. Well, they would take the line from the older ones, wouldn't they?
And they were just as good once they got over there?
Yes. There was exceptions, you know, as fellows who wanted to show themselves as brave, as wanting to be competent in their job and willing to do this and willing to do that. But in the majority of cases, the officers stood back and let the men do it, or the NCOs. Oh, yes. My solid opinion.
Did they have better treatment than the men? Were their living conditions?
Well, certainly all the way. You go up into the frontline trench, and a company would have a length of trench allotted to them. The party that went up a couple of hours beforehand would say to this company officer, well, now your length of trench is there and so on. There's a couple of dugouts you could make use of. And, of course, he would say, right, to his batman, you know, his orderly, go and put my things in that dugout. The dugouts in the frontline trench were just sort of a hole dug in the back of the parapet door, way up out of the water, and sort of just dug out. They used to dig the soil out in the back. Had to be strengthened with timber to keep it up, and room for a couple of people to be able to lie in it.
How far back would it go into the wall of the trench?
Well, you see, we used to use that soil for filling sandbags for the renewal, when you were renewing your frontline trench. Well, some of them would be fairly deep back, others for a couple of men to lie in it, you see, some only for one man. There was no such things. In 1915 and 16, there was no such things as dugouts where you went down. Now, I've been out there since the war, and on the Somme, in the front, which they tell me was the front line, and you went down and down and down, and then you come into a sort of a